Hello and welcome to the Slow Home Podcast. This is a podcast all about slow living in a fast-paced world. And I'm Brooke McCallery.
I'm Ben McCallery and welcome to episode 213. In this episode, you speak to the lovely Chelsea Pottinger.
I do indeed.
So who's Chelsea?
So Chelsea is she's a mindfulness expert. She's studying to be a clinical psychologist. Chelsea is also someone who has had a very similar trajectory through like early parenthood to me.
Okay.
We connected over Facebook actually, and Chelsea shared a bit of her story, and I knew that I wanted to talk to her because timing is perfect, really. Yeah. It's Postnatal Depression Awareness Week right now in Australia, and Chelsea and I have both suffered postnatal depression and interestingly have both used it as a vehicle for improving our mental health. Not just in that kind of circle of postnatal depression, but in every area of life. And Chelsea and I have both kind of used it to create a new chapter of work and life. So it was really wonderful to sit down and talk to her about it.
Now, following this conversation, you came out and you said something really, really interesting to me. Do you remember what you said?
I remember what I said.
Why don't you share it and explain why you said it?
Well, I said that I was glad for my postnatal depression in the end. Not glad for the impact that it had on you or the kids or people around us, because I understand the toll it took. But I can see it now as a blessing, as the blessing that it was, because it forced me to be challenged and to be highly uncomfortable and to really examine myself and my self-beliefs and my behaviors and thought patterns, and really had to dig deep into that stuff over a period of a number of years. And that led me here. You know, as anyone who's listened to the podcast for any length of time knows, it was my psychiatrist who introduced me to the idea of simplifying. And as a result of that, I found Zen Habits, like the blog Zen Habits. And then, you know, everything really kind of snowballed from there. I started to declutter, and then that shifted the way that I viewed the world slightly, which shifted my behaviors. And, you know, that's like the rest is kind of what the last 5 years has been made up of. So while I don't want to underplay how difficult and awful it was, and the fact that I saw a psychiatrist for a number of years and was on medication for a number of years, that was all an integral part of the story. But I feel like the challenges have led me here, and I'm glad for it.
Me too.
Yeah. So Chelsea and I speak about that quite a bit in our conversation. And I think, first of all, I do want to say that she doesn't pull any punches when she talks about her experience of postnatal depression. So if you have struggled, if you are struggling, if you know someone who's struggling, I just want to let you know that it gets kind of dark for a minute there. And I'd still encourage you to listen, but I just want you to be sort of forewarned of that, because I know that can be very challenging to take when you're in, when you're in the midst of it. Mm-hmm. However, Chelsea talks about how she continued to work through it, and, you know, the inspiration that she took from her experience, and how she now helps other people to work through their postnatal depression. She actually is a supporter, an ambassador for the Gidget Foundation and Are You Okay Day as well. But the Gidget Foundation specifically is an Australian organisation that supports women with postnatal depression and puts together resources for partners of women, you know, checklists and things like that that allow maybe early or earlier intervention. But they also offer 10 free clinical psychologist appointments for anyone who gets in touch with them who thinks that they may be suffering from postnatal depression.
That's fantastic.
It's brilliant. It's an incredible service that I wasn't aware of. So this has really become Chelsea's life work.
Wow.
Hmm.
That is so good. So where can people go and find out more about Chelsea and about all the incredible things that she's doing?
So as always, we've got the show notes. So slowyourhome.com/213 for everything that we speak about today. But you can also go to gidgetfoundation.com.au directly, and to eqconsultingco.com for Chelsea's business. So the other side of what she does, she works with massive organisations to help develop mindfulness and well-being programs. And she and I talk about that a lot too, because I'm often asked by people who work in corporate environments, how do I slow down? How do I find mindfulness when the expectation on me is to work these hours and to be constantly available? And I found it really heartening to hear that there are so many organizations looking to really embrace that. Chelsea does tell a story about an organization who didn't, but I think there's some really interesting information in there for people who are looking to find that kind of elusive balance, even though they're working in corporate world. So yeah, that's what EQ Consulting's all about.
That is awesome.
It is. I think it's really awesome. So I think we should get into it. And take some deep breaths and just enjoy the positivity of Chelsea as well. She's someone who's come through the other side of something really, really difficult. And I hope it's inspiring, because it was for me. So enjoy. Chelsea, hello.
Hi, Brooke.
How are you?
I am excellent, thank you. How are you going?
So well, so well. We were just talking before we hit record about the birds in the background of your microphone there, and it's so lovely to chat with you on a Friday morning and just take a minute to have a great conversation.
Yeah, we're so blessed, huh? Like Blue Mountains, Gerringong. I honestly think we live in heaven.
Yeah, you live in such a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, it's stunning. Very, very lucky. My office, literally, I'm sitting here looking out onto the cows and the horses in the background. It's just lush.
Oh, that's gorgeous. That just makes me feel relaxed thinking about it. All right, so now we've placed ourselves mentally. I want to talk to you about your extraordinary work and your life over the past few years, because you and I have had a significantly parallel kind of experience, I think, as mothers, both going through postnatal depression, both using that as a vehicle to shift into mindful living and paying attention and putting the important things at the center. But that was not always your MO, was it? What was life like for you, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, so before Clara was born, we lived in Rose Bay in Sydney, and the hustle and bustle of the city, really. So I worked in the corporate world. I would do very, very long days. I didn't have very healthy coping strategies back then, so I would sort of medicate myself at night times with alcohol. I would go out partying quite late with clients, and then I'll do triathlon training. And I knew yoga was good for me, so I'd quickly run to yoga to try and decompress while my mind was very active. And then, as we were saying before, Brooke, you know, playing the piano with that one hand, downing Hendrix gin was my vice back then, with the other. And that was my life, this very unsustainable pace and very, very fast pace before we gave birth to Clara.
So it's sort of this, and I think it's familiar to a lot of people, this kind of peaks and troughs of high stress, busyness, hectic kind of life, and trying to balance that out, but not in a necessarily helpful way. So balancing it out by self-medicating with booze, or, you know, like crashing, the inevitable crash and burn that I would experience probably every 3 months when I was living like that. Every kind of few months I would get sick, and that would just be my body going, okay, you need to just stop for a minute. Yeah, I think that sort of peak and trough of activity and downtime is, yeah, really relatable. What did life look like after you gave birth to Clara?
So we had a beautiful birth. We had to have a cesarean, but that was okay. I was already in the medical field, so I knew what to expect. And gorgeous birth. And then because we'd been wanting as well, Brooke, a baby for about 4 years, we're trying. And then we're about to start IVF. And usually this happens, the IVF specialist goes on holidays and then you sort of fall pregnant naturally, which is just bizarre. So we fell pregnant naturally just when our IVF specialist went away on holidays. And so we're really excited. I had a beautiful pregnancy. And then after Clara, around day three, when sort of all that milk comes in and the hormones, most mothers will know, you know, they get those blues on day three. Yep. And I got them very, very severely. So day three, milk came in. We actually got transferred down to Coogee Bay Hotel, which part of Prince of Wales Private there, you get the option to go down to Coogee Bay Hotel if you feel like you're getting it all together. And I sort of had that mask up going, yeah, I've got it all together. I just want to get down to Coogee Bay to eat a yummy grass-fed steak and have a glass of wine with Jay. And on that day, when all that milk came in, the hormones, that was literally the day that my neurochemicals went berserk. That night, the anxiety, insomnia just kicked off straight away. So Clara was sleeping really well and I was awake all night. And the next morning with a little like minimal sleep, I was having these premonitions of jumping off the balcony down at Coogee. And I didn't tell anyone that because that was very, very scary. And I'd never experienced mental health prior to giving birth to Clara. So I just thought, that's really weird, Chels. Why would you even be wanting to do that? Don't say anything. And from there it went to – I told the nurse that was on that day what around the sleep, you know, the insomnia that I was having. And she said, oh, well, that's no good. Tonight we'll give you a temazepam. So very strange because you're breastfeeding as well and taking these sleeping pills. And I was having a really, really big difficulty with actually the breastfeeding. I just couldn't get the latching properly and I was bleeding and I was just in a lot of pain. Anyway, the insomnia was still there and I was getting quite anxious about the breastfeeding and knowing that breast, you know, I'm thinking, oh, the breast will be great for Clara's gut health and putting all this pressure on myself. So we left there day five and went home. And it's really interesting, you know, I watched my husband, who was just completely elated and having these amazing, just so in love with our daughter. And I was just looking at him going, well, why don't I feel like that? You know, I was actually quite jealous of these beautiful emotions that he was having. And I'm like, well, I don't really feel like that. I must come later. Maybe I'm in the baby blues still. And my mother was there, very blessed. I had my mother with me for the first 6 weeks. And mum is like the most optimistic 5'2" just rocket of positivity. And so we were watching Netflix series and laughing about how sleep deprived we were. And she was a very healthy distraction for me when those demons kept coming up. And still the lack of sleep and still having insomnia and the anxiety was high. Another big red flag that I didn't know at the time was supervigilance to sound. So everything was sort of hypersensitive. I felt like there was sort of a truck coming into my bedroom in Rose Bay every night. I wanted Clara to move out of our bedroom within the first week. I'm like, Jay, just pop her down in the kitchen away from me so I can get some sleep. You know, Jay's like, darling, how can you say that? You know, I'm keeping her near me. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? Like we need to get some rest. And then my mother left at week six and I had my checkup with the GP. And she gave me some temazepam again. So at this stage when you've got severe anxiety and you have insomnia, you'll do anything to get sleep. Well, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, I need sleep. I know how important sleep is. I need to get some rest. I'm only probably having 1 to 2 hours max a night. And the GP said, I think you need to have some temazepam for the next few days. So that's when the addiction to temazepam started. And every day when my mum left, I would just be crying every day. Kept putting on this beautiful mask to everybody, just saying, oh, yeah, I'm loving it and it's going really well. And
just saying all the things that you thought you needed to say. Yeah, I was absolutely exactly the same. Yeah.
I even went to, you know, Double Bay Mothers Group. Everyone looked like they had it going on. You know, they looked gorgeous with their blow dryers and their kids were just doing really well and they were sleeping through and they're all breastfeeding.
Comparison is such a bitch, isn't it? Seriously, it just...
I know. Oh,
it's so damaging.
It's very damaging, and it's very damaging when you're not real with each other. And I would be there at 11 in the morning going, right, does anyone else want to have a Hendrix right now? Or my child's not sleeping through and I'm really struggling and I'm going to have to put Clara onto formula. And so we had to make that move too. You know, I had to change over to formula because I just could not get this breastfeeding thing. And the shame and guilt that comes with that on yourself, you know, is just that was intense. And then I thought maybe that's why I'm feeling really sad is because I have to breastfeed Clara and I see her as the source of my pain. And so every time Jay would bring her to me to breastfeed, I'd be like, okay, darling, quick, take her away. And I didn't even want to cuddle her. And again, we just had no idea about postnatal depression because I'd never experienced mental health. So I didn't even, in that chapter in the book, I just, you know, flipped through that. I thought, I don't need to read that. I would never get postnatal depression. And my girlfriends, if you had to ask them too, that I would be the least likely candidate to them to actually get PND.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're the same.
Yeah. And I also think that I just assumed that that was what it was like. I mean, so I wasn't diagnosed until we had our second baby, but I know for a fact that I was going through very much the same sort of struggles when our first baby was born. And I just thought that that's what parenthood was. I really did. Yeah. I didn't know any different. And I would look at other people and go, well, are they obviously, you know, they're saying all these things and I'm saying the same things, but, you know, they're feeling what I'm feeling. And in a certain, I think it's really important to talk about it, I guess, and go that, yes, we are all struggling in certain ways, but to also differentiate between those struggles and what you and I both experienced, which was, you know, maybe more severe than the baby blues or like those first few days where everyone's feeling those kind of tumultuous emotions, you know, and if it's prolonged.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is so true. And it's so important to know that, you know, if you are crying for longer than 2 weeks, if you have got supervigilance to sound, if you have got insomnia, if you start to socially isolate yourself, if you
are having just described me.
And me. But it's so important to, and not just for yourself, because sometimes you don't even recognize it, but for the people around you that love you, to be aware of what those symptoms are, so when things aren't going to plan, that they know where to go.
And what did you do? I mean, what did you do when you finally realized, or your partner finally realized that, okay, we need to do something here?
Yeah. So I think it was when I was going over to Scotland, actually, at week 9, I was, that's another thing. I was quite easily happy to escape for a few weeks and leave my newborn at home. And that's another little red flag, you know, that whole baby bonding issue for me was definitely apparent there, but no one else was picking up on it because I had that beautiful mask up going, oh yeah, no, isn't she beautiful? While I looked on at Clara, not even recognizing her as my own baby. You know, I didn't even think that she was a part of me. It was just so strange. And week 9, I was meant to be next to my best friend in Scotland as her bridesmaid, and I'd packed my bags, had the money exchanged, really excited to be escaping because I thought, oh, if I can just get over there for 2 weeks, get some sleep, and then I can come back and be the, you know, be the good mum and be, you know, how everyone else is. And again, comparing, guilt, shame, thinking I've got to get it, I've got to snap out of this soon. Anyway, that day that I was escaping to Scotland, I suffered a huge panic attack on the way to the airport, and it went from wanting to escape to then thinking, you know what, Chelsea, you've got this addiction to temazepam, you're taking three temazepams a night and you're still not sleeping, you have such severe depression, I don't think that there's a way out of it, maybe the only way out of this is to actually end my life. And that's the day that I literally pulled over the car, and instead of going to the airport, I started Googling ways to end it. And I'd convinced myself, and this is why I have such empathy now to mental health, and it just makes me so sad when we lose someone to postnatal depression or to someone to suicide, you know, because I've been where they've been in that lens, and we've convinced yourself that you're a burden to everybody else and that life will be actually better off without you in it. And you know, and I started that day, I was visualizing Jay marrying somebody else and him and Clara being happy with somebody else, and thinking, oh, you know what, they're actually really going to thank me. This is probably the most selfless thing that I can do. And people that have never experienced suicidal ideation, and where we view it as being a very selfish act, I can tell you right now that person that is experiencing it are thinking that they're doing actually a favor and they're doing the most selfless act they could possibly do, which is very, very sad, because it's just a very irrational brain and a very big neurochemical imbalance usually that's going on inside there. So anyway, I drove home and to make some plans of how to carry out the act that day, and my husband was there. He looked at me and I was an absolute mess, Brooke. Like, I was so anxious and crying, and I was just completely had crumbled. And he said, you know, darling, he's like, what is going on? He's like, are you okay? And I just looked at him and I'm like, babe, I'm not. I'm not coping. I'm really not well. In fact, I keep thinking if the plane goes down to Scotland, it's going to be a better outcome for everyone. And I think you and Clara are really going to thank me. And I think it's time that I probably just end this for myself and end the suffering for you and her. And the look on his face, Brooke, you know, it just totally broke him. It absolutely, and he's just like, darling, I love you. Clara loves you. We need you as a mother. And it's time we get your professional help. You're not going to Scotland. And I thought, yeah, thank God. And it was just so great that that conversation was so liberating because I could take the mask off. I could drop my ego. I didn't have to be the perfect mum in Rose Bay anymore. I could just be me, you know, and raw and just and then very blessed that I have a cousin who's a psychiatrist, and we called her and she said, you know, Chelsea, oh, my God, you've got severe PND. I need to get you into hospital tomorrow morning. And so I went and had a hospital stay at a postnatal depression unit in Sydney at a private hospital there, which is another bugbear of mine because there's only 12 beds in New South Wales and it's a private unit. So if you don't have 50 grand and you don't have private health insurance, you can't get in. So then our public patients go to the psychiatry, you know, to the actual psychiatry units in public hospitals, and they take the baby off them. And then you're in there with drug dependencies and every other type of patient. So that would be that's my dream for the rest of my life, Brooke, is to lobby with the government to get a postnatal depression unit in New South Wales that's for public.
Right.
Every other state has one.
Right.
And just to create awareness then, you know, with where to go. You know, if you're severe like that where I was, I don't know how severe you were, Brooke, if you were at the suicidal point.
Yeah, it was something that I had started to think about and they were never thoughts that I'd had before, you know, and that terrified me. And that was when I spoke to my husband. And I knew then that was when the voice said, hey, this is actually not just what new motherhood looks like. You know, there's something else significant at play here. Talk to someone. And even still muttering those words, I'm not okay, was so hard.
It's hard, isn't it? To be vulnerable like that.
Yeah, but so relieving as soon as they were said as well.
So empowering.
Yeah.
So empowering. And that's where the strength comes from because then sometimes when we're that dark and we have such bad brain fog, we can't make the decisions for ourselves.
No.
And we need those loved ones to actually hold us up while we can't hold ourselves up and get us to the right places.
Mm. And you really have taken it now as your life's mission to empower other people with knowledge, I guess, partners and mothers, of services that are available to them and, you know, things that they can do in order to care for themselves during this period of time. And you've really made that your life's work since, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. So since recovering fully from the postnatal depression, I became an ambassador for the Gidget Foundation and for Are You Okay?
Mm-hmm.
A few reasons. Are You Okay were the three words that literally saved my life when my husband asked me that. And I thought, wow, they're so powerful, so simple yet so powerful, and it's something easily that we can ask people every day to start a conversation. And I'm really proud about what that organisation is doing. And then the other organisation that I feel very passionately about is the Gidget Foundation. So if there's any mothers or fathers, because 100,000 women get postnatal depression every year, 100,000, which is huge, and we don't know where to go, you know, and the Gidget Foundation is there, and they're incredible. They're an incredible resource for people even before you have the baby. If you feel like you could be someone that may be susceptible to postnatal depression, or even after you give birth and your husband notices a few things a little bit off center, then I would absolutely encourage you to get in touch with the Gidget Foundation as your first point of call. Brooke will leave the number and the website in her show notes. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Brooke.
No, that's fine.
And for anyone who needs it right now, the number's 1-300-851-758. And you get 10 free clinical psychology appointments. And the thing I love the most about the Gidget Foundation is that their clinical psychologists actually specialise in postnatal depression.
Right.
So you're going to the right place, you're getting the right resources, you're getting the right tools even before you're having the baby. And then you're also having people that truly understand postnatal depression alongside of you, and it's free. So I think that's incredible, and I think more and more people need to be aware of the Gidget Foundation.
Well, that's it. I mean, I wasn't aware of the services they offered. I think it's phenomenal, and I imagine there are so many people who are going through something along these kind of lines at the moment who probably don't know about it. So I'm incredibly glad to have heard about it and to be spreading the word. So I will include all of those details in the show notes, but absolutely get in touch if you need. Now, that's Is that New South Wales specific, Australia-wide?
That's Australia-wide. Great. So they'll do this, starting to do Skype calls. They've just opened up a centre over in Western Australia.
Okay.
And, yeah, so even having a look at their website, which is gidgetfoundation.com.au, and just getting in touch with them, even if you feel like you could be susceptible to it, because it's the type A, high-functioning, perfectionist, you know, the people that I was in hospital with were doctors, lawyers, very high-functioning females, and we'd all completely crumbled. And sometimes it's the least likely are the most likely that actually get it.
Mm.
And so just being aware of that, because I didn't know about the Gidget Foundation either, Brooke, and it would have dramatically stopped me slipping into the darkness and depths of PND if I had got in touch with them sooner.
Mm. Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing about that.
My pleasure.
The other thing that you've really thrown yourself into over the past couple of years has been the study of mindfulness as well. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So when I went into the hospital, I had the most amazing psychiatrist, and she taught me everything around mindfulness, meditation, the neuroscience behind the meditation. And because when she first told me that I had to start meditating on day three, I said to her, please don't come at me with that spiritual stuff. That was
absolutely my response.
I'm like, I'm not going to wear a caftan and smell like essential oils and say om underneath the tree. And she's like, no, I'm going to come at it as a from a clinical perspective.
Mm.
And when she informed me about, you know, neuroplasticity, which just means that the brain can literally mold and change, and we can grow parts bigger, grow parts smaller, just as we do when we go to the gym, I became very curious to understand more, and then very intrinsically motivated when she said to me, Chelsea, if you meditate for the rest of your life, you will never have to be on Zoloft.
Hmm.
And I said to her, that is a big enough hook right there, because I did have to go on Zoloft, and I think the medication is phenomenal. I had to go on it for a year, and it really did save my life while I could learn all these other coping tools. And so she started teaching me about that, and I very, very challenging for me day three, because I had such severe anxiety and depression. I mean, you're trying to sit for 2 or 3 minutes with no stimulus coming in, and you're just sitting there with those demons. That can be very, very challenging. But, you know, 4 weeks later, my whole shift and perspective was changing. I was becoming a lot calmer, a lot less anxious, and she taught me everything about gut health. She taught me everything about so much, you know, gut health, sleep hygiene, resilience. And then when I was leaving, she said, I think you'd be a beautiful clinical psychologist.
Wow.
And I thought, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. And I thought, there has to be a reason why I've ended up in here in the hospital. You know, when you start reflecting back on severe adversity in your life, and you can look and you try and look for the lesson. What is the lesson in this? And, you know, in the first few days, I'm like, why me? Why me? Why can this happen to me? And then right about week four, I'm like, why not you, Chels?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why not you? You survived this. You're stronger from it. You're calmer from it. And why not you? You can really learn from this and then serve other people in this space. So I left there, spent a lot of time at the Nantin Temple learning loving kindness, compassion, meditation towards myself. And that's just a temple down here in Wollongong. And the Buddhist monks even talked to me a lot about, you know, the reason why I had to go through that huge adversity was to get to my true calling and my true passion in life. And as we were saying before, Brooke, you know, we're so grateful for our children are giving us postnatal depression, because it's really shaped us who we are today.
Absolutely. I look back on it now as a blessing. And I've said to you before we hit record, I don't regret it at all. I do regret the pain that it put my family through, and I regret the impact that it had there. But what I've been able to do as a result, and learn as a result, and grow and evolve as a result of it, I'm incredibly grateful for, because I think it taught me so much about myself, and it was highly uncomfortable and incredibly challenging. But that discomfort also led to a huge amount of self-reflection, I think, and self-learning, and eventually self-care and self-love even, which is something that I never thought I would say. You know, I just never thought I would experience it. I really didn't. I never thought that I would go, hey, you're pretty awesome. That's cool. You know, you're doing well. Like, I just, that was never something I would say to myself, you know. And I think that level of yeah, self-reflection was wonderful in the end.
It's amazing because then you can teach your children that kind of work as well, yeah. That whole self-love, the whole gratitude practice, the whole paying it forward. And when they're so young, I mean, Clara's still too young to learn to meditate just yet, but every morning we get up and we write on the gratitude board and, darling, tell me this morning what you're grateful for. And it's always Nanny, Pippi and Pa. Mm. That's her fave. And but by, you know, through osmosis and through just practicing gratitude, she's literally just building up her insula in her brain, which is where compassion and empathy reside, you know, where it'll change her lens as well in terms of perspective in things. And hopefully she won't be that person when someone cuts off on the road that she gets on the horn and gives them the finger. Hopefully she's like, come on in, have a lovely day.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
My insula is huge, you know?
Courtesy waves for everybody.
Exactly. So, yeah, so I went back into university and I'm doing a PhD in psychology and neuroscience now because I've got this huge fascination with our brain, and then became, you know, the ambassadors for Are You OK? And the Gidget Foundation and internationally accredited mindfulness and meditation teacher. And I said to my husband, imagine teaching these skills to the corporate world.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, teaching professionals coping tools how to decrease stress. You know, I know the unhealthy cruxes, I used to do them, but imagine giving them healthy ones. And not just that, how to improve their resilience and their focus and their productivity from a neuroscience level. And he's like, darling, I love this. And I'm like, I love this too because it's my passion, and corporate's investing into psychological well-being. I think it's so vital for organizations. And so anyway, I started with my very first gig with eBay, and that was a year ago, and they loved it. You know, we did an 8-week mindfulness course with that organization, and then from there we now work with Uber, Dexus Property and Grain Corp and Cook Medical and Aon and Mercedes-Benz.
So really big, really big organizations who are really taking the well-being of their staff and their employees incredibly seriously.
It's amazing, Brooke.
That's wonderful.
And you know what's so wonderful, and it's so empowering to, as you know, being your own business owner, because I actually decline clients who actually don't believe in psychological well-being.
Mm.
And I had a very, very big client that everyone in Australia would know well, and they said to me, look, you're the right look for us, you're the right fit, we'll pay you a lot of money to do this, except we think the guys are a bunch of pussies and they need to pull their socks up. And I'm like, wow.
So that's like, just like, that's the mindfulness well-being version of greenwashing, you know.
And like, that's exactly right. So I just said to the C-suite, I'm like, you're lucky I meditate every day because I'll probably punch you in the face. And I said, I'm going to have to politely decline.
Wow.
Anyway, I left and I flew back, and a week later they emailed me again, doubling my salary.
Oh, my God.
And it's a very, very big ethical thing for me because I don't do it for the money. You know, I do it to make a cultural change and embed change within organizations. And it really does trickle from the top down. If your leader doesn't believe in mental well-being, you know, everyone gives so much precedence to our body over our own mind. You know, we take our bodies to the gym. Probably most people listening to this are at the gym at the moment getting ready for, I don't know, Bondi summer, you know, Tiger Lily swimmers and, right? But we never take our minds to the gym. And if we've got a self-critic or an inner ego and we're down at the beach and we're like, oh, I wish I looked like that person, or I hope no one notices a cellulite in the back of my leg, or, you know, beauty really shines from the inside out. And if people realize that we can train our head, you know, train our brain and upgrade the hardware in there, I think that'd take more time to actually invest into that really important organ.
So when you work in an organization with, you know, for 8 weeks, I think you said, what kind of strategies are you teaching people to be able to more, I guess, cope with work stress?
So it's obviously realigning them back to putting themselves on the top of the to-do list, you know, because I think people very easily slip down that exhaustion funnel. They take on an extra hour of work. They're now working 11-hour days. They don't go to the gym because they just want to do one more hour of emails. So they slip down the funnel and then they go, you know what? I'm now not going to the gym. I'll stop eating healthy, right? So then they do the quick wins, they do the takeaway food, then their sleep gets impacted, and then they slip further and further down. Then the next day they have the triple shot latte, and then it's further down, and they forget to actually book in anything nourishing. So it's really just making them aware again of, you know, how to actually restructure their day. So we teach them things around resilience. We teach them meditation. So, and mindfulness is like the umbrella. You know, meditation is just one coping tool. And we always talk about in the neuroscience in the very first session, the foundations of it, because people need to really understand the science. So the skeptics in the room go, wow, I had no idea that I can improve my memory center. I had no idea that I could decrease my amygdala, which is where my anxiety and stress sits. So what does that mean? That means in 8 weeks' time, I'm going to be less reactive, less stressed, less anxious. Okay, now I'm curious enough to start practicing. And we always start at 3 minutes in that first session, never 20. Mm-hmm. You know, if I sat there, right, and gave them a mantra and taught them transcendental meditation, they would all just run away. So it's just like, you know, it's like taking their bodies to the gym, just 3 minute wins in the meditation space. We teach them heaps of different types of guided ones there. We talk to them about, you know, how long emotions last for in their central nervous system. And some people feel like that lasts for, you know, they get made redundant, they break up with a partner, they lose a loved one. Sometimes those emotions feel like they can last for years. You know, I had someone say, oh, 47 years, that's how long it lasts for. And I'm like, wow, we really need to get you out of that funk, like right away. And it's 90 seconds, 90 seconds. That's how long the emotions last for. That's anger, sadness, fear, unless you talk about it or think about it again and you re-hit your negative feedback loop. So we teach people, you know, five strategies around that of how to break that ruminative pattern, because it's very addictive, it's very destructive for businesses. And it's also, you know, Brooke, if I called you this morning and I had a crappy morning and I dumped that on you straight away, that's going to impact you by 45% your energy. Like this is what this social psychologist Nicholas Christakis shows. He's sort of studied these social networks for 30 years. So it's that whole circle of influence and how you're actually impacting other people as well when you're venting and bitching to them.
Right.
And how important it is, as you know, to keep incredible people in your life. You know, that whole strategy, you become like the five people you spend the most time with. So choose them really wisely. So we teach them how to break those types of those patterns, you know, those negative feedback patterns. We talk to them around their gut health, because everything from your gut is your second brain, and all those neurotransmitters get carried up your vagus nerve straight to your brain. So if people are suffering anxiety, depression, ADHD, we get in check with their gut health straight away. And even from ground zero, where do you even start from there? And we give them some really easy tools to start with gut health management. At the moment, my husband and I are actually just about to get our microbiome checked by a company called Ubiome, which you just do, they check your stools and then they tell you every type of bacteria that are sitting in your gut.
Wow.
And then you manage. I know, how cool.
Yeah, fascinating.
My husband's like the next level. He just literally measured his blood glucose for the last 2 weeks to see what's spiking his insulin response and how to get into a keto sort of state easier. So he's just another level of health and fitness. But we talk to them as well around, you know, with the meditation, we talk to them biofeedback. So we give them use headsets so they can, which is really cool actually, because I think it's good if you can measure these kind of things, just so you know what's happening when you, so these Muse headsets, they're called,
yeah.
And they literally wrap around your prefrontal cortex, like at the front of your brain. You plug in, you start meditating. When you meditate, we take you from a beta brainwave, which is just that chronic stress state, which is, you know, if people who are listening, they check their phone first up in the morning. I don't know if anyone's guilty of that. But, you know, you wake up and instead of even kissing your husband good morning, you roll over, flick off your phone, off the alarm, and then you check your emails. Now, once you do that, you literally go from this beautiful delta brainwave of sleep and zoom straight up into a beta brainwave, straight up into stress.
Wow.
And unless you have coping tools to get you back into a theta brainwave, then you stay there for the rest of the day. That's why I really encourage people not to even check their phone for the first hour and a half in the morning.
Yeah, just that's one of my favorite things to do. So screen-free bedrooms and just, keep your brain in that state that it's in when you wake up before you allow the entire world to dump into, you know.
To dump in?
Yeah, onto your shoulders and into your head.
Absolutely. Onto your shoulders, into your head. I love that. That's so true, because you're coming out of a gorgeous brainwave. It's a great time to meditate. It's a great time to set an intention, you know, because what you really do say to yourself and what you believe, you truly do embody that, and that's what you become for the day. So even setting an intention in the morning of going, today is going to be a beautiful day. Today is going to be a beautiful day. and you just watch the day unfold differently rather than getting up going, I hope I don't have sciatica pain. I hope I don't get caught in traffic and I hope I'm not miserable. And guess what happens? Sciatica, caught in traffic, miserable day. You know, and it's that whole thing of feeding your brain, feed it love, feed it truth constantly. And we talk to corporates about productivity, how to squash procrastination and minimize multitasking. So we teach them tools around that and the neuroscience behind that. Sleep hygiene, gratitude, paying it forward, how to actually understand their stress triggers and how to actually use stress for performance. So we do a whole bunch of different, every session's very, very different, to be honest.
And I was going to ask you, you know, how do you get the organizations or the, you know, the leadership teams on board? But I think you've just answered that question by making it about not solely, but also introducing them to the benefits of increased productivity, which is as a result of, you know, mindful practices. That then becomes appealing to management, not just the employees who are thinking, okay, well, how can I feel less stressed in my day? How can I regain some of that headspace? But management is like, okay, well, how can we use this to improve our workplace, improve our outputs? And I think that they're the same thing. You know, I think it's just a matter of presenting that to the various parties as benefits to both of them.
Absolutely, because the C-suite definitely notices when their people are arriving on Monday happy and less stressed at work. You know, the sky's the limit. They're noticing huge changes, and even engagement across the organization is changing. But you absolutely need that buy-in from the CEO and the HR directors who are leading the change within the organization to make sure that it's sticking, that the cultural change is sticking. And a lot of these organizations that I work with now have made incredible meditation spaces and rooms for their employees to go and practice and have quiet time. And I think they realize, you know, people like Richard Branson and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, Barack Obama, they all meditate. And there's a reason why they do that. You know, they know something that we didn't know, and it gives them a sharper brain. It makes them disrupt the world differently. They become more creative. Mm. You know, pre-Steve Jobs, before he passed away, he used to say that all the time, that that's where his divine intelligence comes from, is from his transcendental meditation practice. Mm. And you speak to Hugh Jackman, who's an ambassador of RUAK, and he talks about it as well. Like, there's no way he could be focused and calm on stage or when he's acting, but if he didn't practice meditation. And then he's a completely different person since. And so am I. You know, you watch, my husband was such a skeptic, Brooke. And when I left the hospital, I'm like, oh, I'm meditating. I'm going to study a PhD in psychology. And he was the same. He's like, babe, you can just do that fluffy stuff and I'm going to keep working in banking. And, you know, he watched me and I just never pushed it on him ever. And he watched me transform to this such a calm person that never gets really rattled anymore. And then I'd just bring home the science from uni going, hey, babe, guess what's happening inside my brain this week? Oh, my God, my creativity, my focus, my prefrontal's growing. How cool is that? And then 6 months later, he's like, darling, I think it's time. I think it's time we do 10 minutes together.
Oh, like, that's awesome. Yeah.
And now he meditates twice a day, 20 minutes a day, and he's probably the calmest, happiest banker in Sydney.
Yeah, and I think that that's the way to encourage someone, not even encourage, to invite over time someone to join you, is to simply like live it, exemplify it, and you will over time show them the benefits that you're experiencing, and over time they will think, hey, I want a piece of that, and start to adopt it. Because I don't think you can drag someone into those kinds of changes if they're unwilling. You know, that there will be resentment, they'll half-ass their efforts, and they'll be cynical or skeptical of it because they never really wanted to be there in the first place. So I think that that's such a beautiful example of how you were invitational without being at all prescriptive or, you know, demanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's with everything in life, right? Like it's that whole intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic. And the CEOs of the companies actually don't make it mandatory, this training. It's completely selective. And it's great because you get the people in the room that go, I really want to be here. I'm really curious about this. And then they, when they finish the 8 weeks, go and tell all the other employees. And the next, you know, group signs in going, I'm so excited. And it's that whole thing as a mindfulness practitioner that I can't grab you by your beautiful top, Brooke, and go, Brooke, you have to meditate every single day for the rest of your life, you know? Like, that's outrageous. If I can give you some knowledge and then you intrinsically go, okay, I think this is going to really benefit not just my life, but my children's life and my husband's life. This is a practice that I'm going to commit to.
Mm.
And I think you're absolutely spot on with that.
No, I think that's a wonderful example. Just before we go, can I ask you about your days? Because I think that, you know, people listen to the Slow Home podcast and they get stuck on the idea of slow and the expectation that it is, you know, like a pace thing, you know, and it can absolutely can be. But they also ask me a lot about the fact that my life seems quite full. And I think that there's a very big difference between a full and fulfilling life and a hectic and mindlessly overwhelmed and overcommitted life. And often talk about the things that I do to stop me from shifting from one to the other. What do you do in your day-to-day to stop you from tipping into that point of overcommitment and overwhelm?
Great question. So one thing that I introduced this year was two days off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
So Tuesdays, no one will ever find me. Even when corporates email me, my out of office says, "Hi, I'm currently off the grid with my daughter hiking. I'll be back in the office on Wednesday."
So awesome.
So that's a non-negotiable day for me. And Clara and I have the most beautiful day. We have a gorgeous little date and we roll out the day lovely. And I will not have my phone or computer anywhere near me. It's just me and her purely just living in the moment. Sundays are the same. So Sundays, no one will find my family. The same scenario. So Sundays, Mondays is our, and people are like, "Oh my God, how can you do that?" I promise you, when you do it once, you'll be like, "How did I never do it before?" You know, because that one day feels like 2 weeks. It's just the most incredible thing. Secondly is I work in 90-minute blocks during the day. So I do have a very full and fulfilled life. So I'm extremely productive and efficient with my time. So as the sleep psychologists and neuroscientists show, you know, at nighttime we have those, you know, those deep REMs and light REMs, and they usually go for about 90-minute blocks.
Mm.
So the same during the day.
Mm.
So I will work hard for 90 minutes, then I'll take a 20-minute break where I'll go and meditate, back in the saddle for 90 minutes. Then I'll take a 20-minute break. I might put on a slow cooker at home if I'm here at home, back in the saddle for 90 minutes. And that's how my day operates unless I'm presenting. So I work 3 days a week in workshops, in corporate workshops, and I don't take on any more than that. So if clients ask me to squeeze in the extra day, I say no. So I say, you know, I'm actually booked out till February 2018. I can take you on there. Otherwise, please feel comfortable hiring another organization. Mm. So very strict boundaries. And that was a big thing, actually, Brooke, that my mentor taught me this year was say no first in a really kind, polite way, and then digest it. And then if you can, you know, comfortably take it on, then say yes.
Yeah.
And I love that because I used to be the biggest people pleaser.
Same.
And I was the biggest yes man.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, everyone knew that they could call Chelsea and I was like the wingman. Not anymore.
I think that's a skill that we need to develop. Mm. I don't know if it's necessarily a female thing or, you know, a personality thing, but I know so many people who that's their biggest obstacle to simplifying their life or committing a little less is how do I say no? I don't want to disappoint people. I don't want to, you know, to have to say the actual word of no to someone and see that look on their face. My mate Kelly Exeter always encourages people to just say, "Let me get back to you." You know, as a way of learning how to embrace no, because it gives you that space, right, to, you know, to consider, and for the person doing the asking as well to consider that the answer may actually be no, you know, whereas I think when we're kind of hit up with something face-to-face, sneak attack kind of style, the expectation is that we'll say yes. So I love that as a strategy for people learning to say no, let me get back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's huge, you know, even because your time is so precious, Brooke. You know, you're a beautiful mother as well, and you've got your own business. And I'm very protective over my time, and it's and I make sure I meditate twice a day. That's a non-negotiable for me. So I always sit in the morning and in the afternoon and meditate 20 minutes a time. And people are like, "How do you even have the time to do that?" And the way that I feel after I meditate, and the focus, and the creativity, and the productivity that I have, that's a non-negotiable in my life.
So, how do I not have the time to do it?
Exactly. Yeah. It just adds so much to my business, and probably one of the other things again is that whole thing of just remembering what you say yes to, you're saying no to something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the same with the people you hang out with. If you're hanging out with someone that drains you and pulls you down, that means you're saying no to the people that uplift you. So it's like that. I do that with every aspect now in my life. It's just going, okay, if I say yes to this, what am I saying no to? Mm. If I say yes to this beautiful podcast with you right now, what am I saying no to? And if that yes is greater than the no, then absolutely I'll schedule it in. And even now people ask me to help them, you know, with their business, you know, to create a business. And to be honest, that's not, you know, that's not my, I've only been in business for a year. And it, I find that very, very challenging, you know, giving people enough time in that area. So I'll just say, look, I can book you in next Wednesday at 2 a.m. if you like. I'll send them a calendar invite. And they'll write back going, oh, I think you got it wrong at 2 a.m. in the morning. I'm like, no, that's correct. That's the only time I have to do this. If you'd like to take it, then I'll book you in. Because then what happens is it weeds out the 95% of people that are not, you know, super keen and
sure,
got that inner resilience and grit to actually go ahead and do a business plan and create this life that they want. And the 5% that say, yeah, I'll take it, then I usually free up my diary the next day.
That is gold.
Isn't it brilliant? Yeah, I know. My husband taught me that and I thought that is awesome, because it is, again, your time is so precious and that time with your family. And that's why even with clients, people that aren't aligned to my values, I don't work with. My friends, if there's anyone that's toxic and bitchy, they get spring cleaned in September every year. I go through my phone every September and I spring clean my phone just like I do with my wardrobe. You know, and we're talking about minimalist life, like I own 50 things in my wardrobe, that's it. And my phone gets spring cleaned every September. And anyone that's negative or bitches about anybody that I love, I delete their number.
Mm.
And my mum taught me that. And I thought, Mum, that's really ruthless, but that is so vital for my well-being. And I haven't had to spring clean my phone actually for about 5 years, which is great.
Well, that means you've done your job, yeah.
I've done my job, right? And you should see my friends. They're just amazing. They're my cheerleaders, you know. They have my back. They don't chip me down like tall poppy syndrome happens here in Australia. They massively collaborate with me and, you know, they're there for me 2 a.m. if I need them to be. And, you know, and it's amazing. It's an amazing space to be, because I'm just always happy because of the people I'm around as well. I'm very blessed.
Oh, mate, that's so wonderful. Just to hear the process you've been through over the last couple of years is phenomenal. And, you know, I think incredibly inspiring as well to take your learnings and apply it in a way that's going to help so many people in so many massive ways. So I think, I don't know if I can say it, but I'm really proud of you.
Oh, thanks, Brooke. Likewise, hun. I'm proud of you too.
Oh, thank you.
It's that whole thing. I think that if, you know, the day that, this I say to my husband all the time, the day that I save someone from suicide, you know, a few weeks ago at the Gap, the day that I saved the boy from jumping means so much more to me than 500 kids at uni, you know, giving me applause.
Mm.
It's that whole survivor guilt of postnatal depression is going, you know what, this is my fight now for the rest of my life is to help as many people as I humanly possibly can and get the message out there, and also help people in the professional world so they don't actually burn out.
Yes.
Which I did all the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and it's kind of tackling things from multiple angles as well, you know, allowing people to value themselves and their mental well-being enough so that they perhaps don't get to that point where they're really struggling and going under, and helping those people who have reached that breaking point as well. I think it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Chelsea, thank you so much for your time. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thanks, Brooke. It's been so lovely to meet you as well.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And the 6 degrees of separation.
I know.
That goes on in our life.
Such a small connected world. It's brilliant.
It is.
So I'm going to have links to all of the resources that we spoke about in today's conversation, as well as your website. And yeah, is your website the best place for people to get in touch with you and learn more about what you're doing?
Probably Instagram, to be honest, Brooke.
Great.
Like that's where I'm the most active, and that's just at EQ Consulting Co.
Great.
I just pop up there all the time. Mindful tips, new vegan websites, squatty potties, what are they? You know, like all this stuff, turmeric. Do you have Alzheimer's? Start eating curcumin every morning. All this kind of stuff goes up there. Like I try and make that a really valuable resource, and obviously very honest on there as well that people will see with my postnatal depression stories. So that's probably where... Yeah, that's where I'm the most active, to be honest, over Facebook.
Brilliant.
And the Instagram. Yeah.
Great. I'll point people over there, but EQ Consulting is you, and you've been wonderful. Thank you, Chelsea.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks, Brooke.
Who is that? Hi, Puck.